When women complain about online harassment and abuse, you know what they're often told? Just go offline. Don't use Twitter. Stay away from your email. Well, that's not only unfair. If you're a professional woman, it's not even really possible, at least not without damaging your career. There's a serious financial cost to being a victim of online harassment. So where's the law when you need it? Danielle Citrin is a legal expert on hate crimes in cyberspace and how the law can, and sadly more often can't, help. Steve Paulson asked her to explain.
The first thing, I think, is to go to law enforcement, right? If it's indeed the combination of threats, privacy invasions, so like the posting of nude photographs without your consent, your next to your home address and the suggestion you're interested in sex, defamation, sort of this perfect storm of both terrifying and then reputation damaging. My first advice would be to go to law enforcement. Now,
are you talking about the local police department?
I am. When individuals go to federal law enforcers, FBI, the response is it's not a matter of national security. And it's understandable they have limited resources. And increasingly states, and I'm just going to talk about California for a second, but whose attorney generals are working incredibly hard to train law enforcement or peace officers in California about what it is that is wrongful about harassment and stalking and threats and how it can be punished.
But I'm wondering if police departments are really equipped to deal with this, you know, such a technology-based crime. And because, you know, the people who are doing this are usually pretty tech savvy.
So that's not to say that we don't have a long way to go in terms of educating law enforcement, not only about the law itself, you know, explaining to law enforcement officers that there are these laws on the books that you can enforce, but also the technology. You know, local law enforcement, they're great at street crimes. It's what they do well. And it's true that when you come to them and you say, there's this threat, it's terrifying, and then show series of screenshots, they often don't know the place to start for an investigation. Like, they don't realize that they can get a warrant to go to the online service provider and then get an IP address and then go to an internet service provider. More often than not, people leave crumbs behind that if we have the resources to expend, we can track and, you know, find perpetrators.
And what are the penalties then? I mean, let's say you do track down the offender, and I'm sure it depends on, you know, what kind of abuse we're talking about. What are the penalties?
So, you know, stalking and harassment laws at the state and also at the federal level will often consider the crime a felony. So it's usually this perfect storm of threats of violence, of defamatory comments that hurt reputations, as well as privacy invasions. And sometimes it's your social security number that's spread throughout the internet.
So you're saying that, you know, someone who does all of this or some of this could land in jail. Can you also sue the person for damages?
There are civil remedies. You could sue for public disclosure of private fact, for defamation, for intentional infliction of emotional distress, but it is expensive. And so, you know, most victims, when I talk to them, they said, look, I can't even afford to pay my rent.
Right.
I can't. I've lost my job. I can't find a new one because of my decimated online reputation. Like, how am I going to afford a computer forensic specialist to track down my perpetrator and then hire a lawyer? And that is makes sense. You know, it is a difficult row to hoe. It's expensive. But if you can get a lawyer to represent you pro bono and, you know, with the publishing of my book and high profile attacks on both women in gaming and then, you know, the spread of nude photos of Jennifer Lawrence and others, I think we're gaining some traction and attention to the issue.
What about civil rights law? Does that come into play here?
I feel like that's the heart of my argument of my book, is that we ought to understand cyber harassment as ultimately a civil rights violation, because it deprives people of crucial life opportunities. You know, we think of what is a civil rights violation is when somebody's targeted because of their membership in a group. And the ways in which they're targeted is to deprive them of a job, right, of the ability to speak and engage. And so often the abuse is seemingly we're not sure why someone is targeted, but because they're targeted in such sexually threatening and such sexually demeaning ways, We have some sense of the motive, and it fundamentally deprives people of the ability to work. You know, so 90% of employers use Google as a research tool to when they think about interviewing people. And even employers for their own current employees will use Google as a search to check up on employees. And over 70% of the time, employers say that there is a negative result. So in looking for candidates to interview, over 70% of the time when they use Google, there is a negative result. And the sort of top reasons for why there is a negative result, mean the person doesn't get the interview, doesn't get the job, is nude photos. The second is what seems like threats and lies about the person, like really damaged reputation.
But the problem with a lot of this is, I mean, let's say that you found yourself in this situation, you haven't gotten job interviews, but how are you going to know that you didn't get the interview because your prospective employer has Googled you or name the instance like that? I mean, that seems really hard to figure out.
You know, we can't go to the employer we don't know was ever looking at us, right, and say, you didn't give me a job, right? It's a black box.
Right.
I think there is a really important point, even if civil rights laws as they currently exist can't help us here. But I think in the way that, as an educative matter, to understand cyber stalking as a civil rights problem, because it ultimately more often affects women, and it more often affects women in ways that are sort of sexually threatening and demeaning and reinforce gendered stereotypes that make it really hard to work and to speak and engage on equal terms. And it's important, I think, to think of it in that way and to understand it's not just an individual problem, but a social problem. We all lose as a society when victims retreat and go offline and don't participate in public discourse. Like, we all end up losing when we lose their voices.
What about big social media sites like Facebook and Twitter? I mean, do they have legal and social responsibility to try to curb this abuse?
So two questions there. One is more depressing than the other. You know, the first is legal. Do they have legal responsibility? And the answer is no. So I've been working on this issue since 2007. And I feel like in the early years, as I talked to companies about this problem, it seemed too difficult, at least to many, and especially like Twitter, which was conceived itself as like a free speech platform. But over time, in my discussions with these companies, they've come to understand and appreciate that what stalking, harassment, and threats do is silence people. It pushes their own users off their platforms. And the people engaging in this abuse is contributing very little to their sites. And so what we've seen in the last 2 years is, you know, Twitter, Facebook, even Reddit banning non-consensual pornography, so the posting of people's nude photos without their consent.
And, so you just can complain and they will get pulled off.
And they'll take it down. And even Google and Bing will de-index nude images if you let them know that it's non-consensual pornography in searches of your name. So it doesn't take down the content from the main site, but it will de-index in a search of a victim's name, which is often very much what they want, right, is to not have employers and clients and friends see. And Twitter, this was about a year or 2 years ago, made clear that they think that cyber stalking, harassment, and threats is really costly and that it deprives people of the ability to be digital citizens. This is, I'm sort of paraphrasing the general counsel. And I think increasingly we're seeing sort of a set of agreements that online abuse is incredibly destructive, and it's destructive of their own communities. And it's not, economically a good thing for them either. You know, we saw advertisers pull out of Facebook when there were these pro-rape pages. And you had a change.org campaign run by Soraya Shamali and Jacqueline Friedman, who were, gathering all sorts of petitions for Facebook to realize that this is not a good thing, these pro-rape pages. Like, rape is not a joke. And advertisers, including Toyota, started pulling out their ads. And so I think what Facebook realized, and then they made this big announcement, we're going to take down these pages, and we know it's not humor and it's destructive, is they realized it's not good for business.
Right. Now, we're talking about really a pretty recent phenomenon here, I mean, which is really the result of new technology, which keeps changing. And I'm wondering if there are any historical analogies here. I mean, you know, domestic abuse, sexual harassment, big issues a few decades ago. Can we learn anything from how people, how lawyers responded to those problems?
Absolutely. You know, I felt like in researching and thinking about the book, that the very same arguments that women heard in the 60s about domestic violence and about sexual harassment in the workplace, that, oh, come on, boys will be boys. If you don't like it, leave, right? If we think about domestic abuse, those same ways we once trivialized domestic violence and sexual harassment in the workplace were the very same arguments that victims of cyber harassment were faced with. The response was like, eh, get over yourself. Boys will be boys, right? Don't take it so seriously. Oh, come on, you don't need to use Twitter, right? So we, you know, we saw a recurrence of this trivialization of really serious harms. And so I take a sort of took a play out of the playbook from social movement of the past, right? The domestic, the folks and lawyers and activists who helped change hearts and minds about the meaning of domestic violence. It used to be like a private problem that families should solve and that police had no business in it. We didn't even call it domestic violence. And in the late 60s, activists gave it a name, right? They called it domestic violence. And the same is true for harassment in the workplace. Kitty McKinnon and others named it as a phenomenon. This is sexual harassment of women in the workplace, right? We needed to name it and understand it and to help people see it as a social problem. And so we've been here before.
And yet my impression, I could be totally wrong, but we hear about individual cases of horrible abuse, right. but I don't really sense a movement here.
The Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Without My Consent are anti-cyber harassment advocacy groups that it's amazing the kind of change that they've helped produce. So let's just think about law as a Geiger counter. Are we getting people's attention? In 2013, there were two states that criminalized non-consensual pornography. And with the dogged help of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Professor Marianne Franks at Miami Law School, we now have 34 states and a proposed federal statute to criminalize an invasion of sexual privacy involving the posting of nude photos. So it's sort of, I think, an amazing thing going from two states to 34 states and a proposed federal statute. And that only happens when you get lawmakers' attention and show it's a really serious social problem.
Danielle Citrin is a legal scholar and the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Steve Paulson talked with her.